Governor Walker, thanks for joining us on the Illinois Edition.
It's my pleasure to be here. Not just here. It's a real pleasure to be back in downstate Illinois, which I love.
30 years since you left the governor's office, and I've read much of your book, The Maverick and the Machine, and I'm curious, why after 30 years do we have the autobiography? Why didn't it happen after 10 years?
Well, I wasn't ready for it, Rich. It's kind of like a wine that has to mature, and I had to let everything settle down. But I wanted to leave an account for my family. That's what really started it. My children and my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, I have got a lot of them, 26 grandchildren and 4 great-grandchildren, and to say nothing of 7 children. And so I wanted to set it right. You know, I was running around a lot during my life, and those kids maybe didn't know a lot of the things that I was doing, and they didn't really know why I was doing them. So I wanted to spell that out. And then I also wanted to, because a lot has been written about me, and some of it I thought needed to be put in perspective. And so I decided to tell the story as I saw it. And then the family was very much against my writing about my time in prison. And, of course, a gentleman who's with us this morning, Taylor Pensino, and another newspaperman, Bob Ellis, they wrote a biography about me, which I thought was darn good. But they did not have the opportunity to go into some parts of my life that I should. And so when I got into this, I decided to, what are the right words? I decided to bare my soul. And I did bare my soul. In this book, you'll find the unvarnished, warts and all, Dan Walker.
What has been your family's reaction now that the book's in print?
Well, my son Charles is here with me. I think it'd be better if he answered that question. So I don't really know what their reaction has been, except for one thing. I still think that they did not want to have that stuff, which was very sordid, about my time in prison.
Well, of course, you know, the time in prison was only 18 months out of how many years of service.
Where do you get that word only, Rich?
18 months.
Only,
I mean.
18 months? I tell you, you go to prison and you won't use that word only. It was hell. You've heard a lot of people use that phrase, country club prison, country club prison,
yes.
Or what do they call it, FedEx or something like that. And I want to tell you, you read this book, you'll never use that phrase again.
What that experience, what did it teach you about prisons, whether federal or state, the administration of prisons, and the people who are incarcerated there?
Well, the biggest thing is there are too many people in prison, absolutely too many. The system has turned into a warehouse system. You're just warehousing people, and you really can't do anything to correct the situation when you're just warehousing. They become not names and not people, but just a number, and that's sad.
And when you were governor, did you have a sense of that?
Not the kind of sense that that one needs. You realize, of course, that I'm talking about the federal system. I'm not really familiar with the state system.
Let's go back to your decision to run for governor. I was fascinated in your book where you talk about the walk, the 2,000-mile walk across Illinois. Your two sons, Charlie and Dan, how old were they at the time?
Well, let's see. Charles was, I believe, 16, and Dan was about 18 or 19 or 20. 20, I guess. They were wonderful to interrupt their lives and come with me. And their being there really made the walk a lot more bearable for me. When they left after about 600 miles, why, it was really lonely out there on the road. But I want to tell you guys, having two of your sons with you day by day, hour by hour, for that long a period of time is just a plain wonderful experience. But that walk, let me talk a little bit about it. Stop me, Rich, if I go on too long. I met the people of downstate Illinois. I was in their homes. I stayed every night with a different family. And these were ordinary folks, not big shots, mm-hmm. just ordinary folks, school teachers, foundry workers, unemployed, you name it. And they taught me about this state and taught me lessons that lasted, that stayed with me when I was governor. You simply cannot, in my opinion, be a good governor if you don't stay in touch with, in your mind, with the people that you're governing. If you break that, if you get distant from them, then you can't be a good chief executive. I decry the fact that the present governor, I'm not going to comment about his performance in office in any detail because I don't live in the state. It would be unfair of me. But I will say this. An old guy came up to me just 2 days ago, and he said, Dan, why has Blagojevich turned his back on the people of downstate Illinois? And a waitress, same vein, she said to me, here in Springfield, why doesn't he live in the executive mansion? You know, my wife and I used to call it the people's house. The people built that mansion, the people paid for that mansion, and the people want to have a feeling that the governor is out there among them. The governor can't understand all of their problems, but at least they can have the feeling that the governor is there. Not up there on the northwest side of Chicago, sitting in an office, but there with them. I know, you know, everybody knows that Chicago is the biggest city and economically is the powerhouse in great part for this state. But downstate is a huge part of this state, and it should not be forgotten. It should be a balance. And we don't, people tell me, we don't have a balance in this state now.
I did not know, Governor, until I read the book that our good friend here, Taylor Pence, and I joined you for a couple of days during that walk back in the early 70s.
Tay, as I call him, Tay walked with me more than any other representative of the media longer. And maybe you don't think about this. That pavement is hot out there in the summertime in Illinois. I can't tell you the number of guys that came out there in tennis shoes. They didn't last very long. I'll tell you another thing. That Tay was with it, and I also did another thing. I didn't slow down. I can walk at a pretty fast clip. And if you're going to try to do 15 to 20 miles a day, then you better step along. And I didn't slow down for the reporters. They had to keep up with me, no matter what they felt. And, you know, Tay, he was right with me, stride by stride. So had a lot of fun. And, you know, I learned from him because I talked with people. I didn't only spout off. I didn't make a single speech for 4 months on that trip. Not one speech did I make. I did a lot of listening. And people like Tay, he taught me. He taught me.
Well, Governor, first of all, let me say I, too, it's good to see you back in Illinois, only for a few days. And I appreciate Rich and Sean letting me join the program here today, only briefly. I will remark that in those days, it's a long time ago, 1971, I was still in pretty good shape. And I had a heck of a time, I will tell you now, Governor, keeping up with you on the 2 days I walked with you. That was a very eye-opening experience for me, and I think that it indicated a new element of political involvement that I had never seen before, and of course it turned out to be successful. If I can, Rich, just illustrate just one anecdote. On the 2 days I was with then-candidate Walker in 1971, there was one overnight, and we stayed at a motel in Avison, Illinois, I think down along US 50, and we had eaten, and I was back in my little room taking notes and assembling what I had gotten today from the governor. But I asked if I could come back to his room about 10 o'clock that night and go over a few more things. I really had him all to myself because there was just Charles and Dan Jr., as I recall, in addition to the governor himself. When I went in his room, he said, come on in, and he had taken off his famous boots, walking boots, and as I recall, white socks. And his feet were in each one was in a bucket with some sort of solution. But I looked at those socks, and the socks were soaked in blood. And I could not believe it. I thought to myself, how can anybody walk with feet that obviously have that many sores and blisters? And I wasn't horrified, but I was quite shocked. I just couldn't figure it out. And you know, it was that kind of thing that indicated to me, you know, this gentleman earns respect, at least for what he's doing, for what he's undertaken. This is a commitment. This is beyond the norm. And this makes this situation more than legitimate. I mean, if this is an indication of what's going on here, you know, it can't be ignored. And at that time, of course, everybody, including myself, thought that Dan Walker had a terrific uphill struggle to go to overcome very popular Paul Simon in the 1972 Democratic primary. But I thought this is something I certainly had not seen, and you had to get away from the State House to see something like this for yourself close up. But the next morning, I rolled out about 8 o'clock, and Dan was already out on the parking lot of this motel dictating his memoirs from the previous day's walk into some little tape recorder or something. And he was walking just naturally, and we took off again, and his brisk stride as we headed toward O'Fallon and then East St. Louis, his brisk stride was something that was tough for me to keep up with, and I couldn't get out of my mind those bloody socks I'd seen the night before, and I didn't know how he was doing it, actually.
Tay, you could imagine, and you guys imagine how I felt. I'm in a car up in Chicago, and I'd just delivered a kind of a speech, and I heard Mayor Daley come on the radio. And Daley was saying, you know, that guy Walker, he went out there and fooled all the people downstate. He drove from town to town, and then he'd get out of a car and go into a television studio and tell about how he walked. He didn't walk. And I got mad. I really did get mad. But I'll tell you who got madder. My son Charles and my son Dan. Because they got me on the phone that night and said, we want to go down there and punch him in the nose. We know we walked. We know what our feet, what happened to our feet. And that guy, well, I better slow down here with my words. We were really mad about that. When you pour your heart and soul physically into something like that, for somebody to come along and knock it down that way is... But let me tell you about that guy, Charles, who's sitting right over there. Did you know he didn't have any blisters? From day one, he never got a single blister. Dan, my son Dan, we had to take him off the walk for a week, broke his heart, because he just couldn't walk with the number of blisters that he had. I had a lot of them, too. But Charles, he got away with it. But I'll tell you, having him there and Dan there, great experience.
Speaking of that walk, I think even 35 years later, it still goes down in history, Illinois history, as one of the great, at least public relations moves of all time for a campaign. How did it come about? How did this idea come about to walk the state?
Well, actually, the idea was that of a guy by the name of Lawton Childs, who became a United States senator and later governor down in the state of Florida. And I'd known Lawton in prior years. He and I had done some quail hunting together. And Lawton told me about his walk, and we were sitting around, the staff and I, what are we going to do? Nobody knows who this guy Dan Walker is. What can we do? And this is the summer, you understand, of 1971. This is almost 2 years before the election. What can we do? And so somebody said, why don't we get into a canoe and paddle the rivers of the state? And we talked about that. We talked about other things. Finally, we came around to let's walk the state. And so we decided to do it. And I had no idea what kind of an ordeal it was going to be, but it turned out to be a real physical ordeal.
Took some mental toughness.
Yes. Mm-hmm. When somebody comes up to you and says, You're running for governor? What state? I'm down in southern Illinois. And I would say, what do you think I'd be doing walking along here in Illinois if I were running for governor of Kentucky? It really kind of got to me. I shouldn't have let my irritation show. What state am I running? Jiminy Christmas. Anyway, there were some funny encounters back in those days. But what heartened me, I think the first thing was a guy came by in a big rig, a big rig, and he leaned out of the cab as he came by, and he yelled, "Keep fighting, Dan, keep fighting." Well, I thought about that. And that symbol of me out there fighting I came to realize meant a lot. But let me tell you another little story. Towards the end of the walk, I was in a cafe in a motel where I had breakfast, and the waitress came over to me. And she said, I'm on my feet for my entire working shift of 8 hours. So I know what being on your feet is all about. And she leaned over and she kissed my cheek. And she said, honey, she said, just take care of your feet, honey. Well, that really kind of got to me as a matter of fact. So that walk is deep within me.
Candidates, politicians running for office always take a positive outlook, a positive view when talking with the media about the prospects and their chances for winning an election. But as you were doing the walk, that, as you point out, was in the summer of 1971. The primary election wasn't until the spring, March of 72. At what point in time after you completed the walk, did you have a sense that it was really going to pay off for you as a candidate for governor?
It never did in the primary. It never did. There were flashes. I think of West Frankfort, Illinois, deep southern Illinois, when I was really low, and I came into that town, and there were people out in the front yard, and people came over to touch me and just wanted to talk with me. And I felt that what I call a Jack Kennedy moment. And I felt then I'm touching something, I'm getting somewhere. And then months later, I'm on a L-flat platform in the heart of Daley's country up there in Chicago. And people got off the L, it was during the morning rush hour. And I didn't have to go to them. They came to me to want to shake my hand or touch me before they turned and ran to get on the train. And I saw the reporter a couple of days later. He'd written a story about that event, that occurrence. But he never said anything about describing it. And I said to him, "Well, you noticed how people acted, and it was a dramatic moment. And why didn't you write about that?" And he said, "Dan, by the time I got to my office, I persuaded myself it didn't happen. It didn't happen." And so I kind of had the same feeling. My staff, bless them, Vic and Nordy and Dave, and they were very careful to keep me informed about what the polls were showing. They wanted me to be down and fighting. And so I stayed down and fighting until, my goodness, we won.
Well, in 1972, you essentially, in the campaign for primary and later for general election, you had to really conduct two separate campaigns. In the primary, you were campaigning against the machine candidate, Paul Simon. But after defeating Simon in the primary, of course, you had to campaign against the incumbent, a Republican, Richard Ogilvie. Talk about the contrasts and comparisons of those two campaigns.
Well, it was difficult to shift gears, as you just said. And I want to tell you, when I had to appear, as I did, before those precinct captains at their ward meetings up there in Chicago, after I had lambasted the Chicago machine for all of those months. And those guys sat there, row after row of them in front of me, and I'm looking at them, and they're looking at me, and they're sitting on their hands, and those were pretty bleak moments. I had to shift gears, but I had to keep on saying some of the things that I said. And I did. I didn't change my tune. I kept on saying some of those things, but I shifted gears in the sense of talking about the need to change state government. And instead of spending as much time talking about the machine, I talked about the need to change state government. So it was always, and this is a common theme in the primary and in the general, about the need to change politics and government. The need to change politics and government. So there was a constant theme there that did not involve a shifting of gears.
And then after winning the primary, you had to take on Richard Ilruvie.
Yes, tough.
What kind of a campaign was that?
Well, it was a hard campaign. He had the money to finance political commercials on television and radio, mostly television. And the theme was, he's been a good governor. And Ogilvie, I gave him a lot of credit. I never said anything to the contrary in the course of that campaign. I gave Ogilvie credit where credit was due. I criticized him for things he did that I thought were wrong, but I gave him credit for other things.
Including the income tax.
No, I never talked much about that, except that whenever it came up, I said the state had to have the income tax. I never criticized Ogilvie for the income tax, not once in that entire campaign. I know how people felt about it, and sure, it played a role in their voting. Not that much a role, I think, as people say, but it did play some of a role. But I talked about, as I said, I talked about change, and I went out to the people. You know, traditionally in downstate Illinois, and most of the people listening to this are from downstate, candidates customarily campaign by going to the county fairs. I didn't cotton much about going to county fairs because you know what happens? A candidate for governor goes to the county fair and the local county chairman takes him over and puts his arm around his shoulder and takes him around to meet people. Well, whom are you meeting? You're meeting Democrats that are already committed. I wanted to meet people that were uncommitted. That's how you win elections, not by getting the vote of a precinct commissioner. He's going to vote for you, of course. So county fairs I stayed away from. And what I did was hop into a Jeep, again with Charles, who's here, and Dan. And we rode all over the state. And we went to the small towns. I'd work a square, go into the stores, talk to the customers. It was really kind of interesting, you know, a little humorous. Every time I would go into a store in one of these small towns, I'd see out of the corners of my eye, see some women in the back of the store, always in the back of the store. And finally, I remarked on this to a storekeeper, and he said, Dan, he said, they're not here to buy anything. They're here to meet you. But they're so they heard you were coming on the radio. But they're bashful. They don't want to come up to you. You have to go to them. And so they hang back in the back of the store. And they're wonderful people. They're just kind of, you know how ladies downstate are. They're kind of bashful. And they're proper. And some things you just don't do. And you don't get forward if you're a woman downstate. It's old-fashioned, but, you know, I kind of like it. So I would go in the back of the store. As soon as I came in the door, I'd go to the back of the store, meet all the people who were back there. And you know what would happen? I found out a lot of those people would go home, and they'd get on the phone, and they would call Sister Kate or Uncle John or Friend Mary and say, you know who I just met? I just met that guy that walked, and he's running for governor. I just met him. Can you imagine anybody at a county fair where they expect to meet politicians going home and calling up somebody and say, you know who I met over at the county fair? Wouldn't happen. So this was a fresh, different way to campaign. I liked it. I like people.
I know you've had considerable amount of time to reflect upon a possible answer to my next question, but I've wondered for years after you lost the primary for re-election in early 76, if you thought about how things might have changed, what would you have done different as you look back that might have secured a defeat of Michael Howlett in that primary of 76?
Rich, I don't go down that road. I never have. What might have been, what I could have done differently, there's no profit in that, and I just don't do it. And I did not do it. I've never done that. I teach my kids. I was with one of my grandchildren just the other day, and I was leaving their home, and I said to him, you know, lift your head up. Hold your head up. Tuck your chin in. Look out, but look up at the stars. Don't look down at the dirt. Look up at the stars and go through life looking up. And don't turn around and look over your shoulder like somebody's following you. Look up. Be positive. Go forward and look up. And I've always believed that, and I try to practice it. And it took me, I want to say to you, you'll find it in this book, I lost that when I went to prison. I lost that. And I went down into the depths, the real depths. I came close. There was a big, tall water tower. And I thought many a time about, as I walked beneath it, I'd look up there and say, well, why not just climb that ladder and step off into nothing? You don't have to jump, you just step off. And nothing swallows you up. And I would think, what happens? Do you lose consciousness before you hit the ground? And I would think about that, and I thought about that a lot. And I'll share this. It's in the book. I'm hesitant. Please forgive me because I'm hesitant. One day I saw the face of Jesus right before me when I closed my eyes like that. There he was. And it happened. Anytime I wanted to close my eyes, there was Jesus, a face of Jesus. Not on the cross, just a face of Jesus. And I acquired a peace from that experience. I had a little prayer book. I kept it under my pillow. And I wrote things in it in code because the guards would search for anything they could get. And I wrote in code the day when I first had that happen, and I wrote the day when it didn't happen anymore. Now, I know the psychologists will tell you that anybody who's gone under extreme mental stress, that kind of thing can happen psychologically. Okay, that's what the psychologists say. So be it. All I know is that he was there. All I know is that he was there. And he gave me peace. Peace. And so I finally found peace in prison.
The half hour is almost gone, Governor. I have one last question.
Yes, sir.
People listening, I'm talking about young people now. What advice do you have for young people about getting into public service, getting into government, running for political office?
Go for it. One of the things that makes me happy now is to see a guy like Barack Obama, who is charging out of the chute and says he's going to run a campaign above it and try to put an end to this politics as usual, the two parties hitting head on and so forth. And I say more power to him. He may very well be able to add some luster to the land of Lincoln and we need it. 126 indictments up there in Chicago and in Springfield for felony acts, felony indictments, 126 of them. I hope that Barack can stay above it in this tough campaign. I hope he can continue to add luster. And most of all, Rich, going back to what you said, I hope he can continue to keep the young people involved. One of the problems we have in this nation is that the young people do not stay involved. And maybe somebody like Obama can keep them involved throughout this long campaign. And if he does that, then he's done a great thing for America.
The name of the book, The Maverick and the Machine, and the author, our guest today, Governor Dan Walker. Governor, thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.